You're listening to Craig Hartman, and this is Chew the Fat. We're in the beautiful studios of Charlottesville Radio Group and, of course, sunny Charlottesville, Virginia. Chew the Fat is your podcast where you listen to great food and beverage personalities. You learn a little bit about what makes them tick. Hopefully you'll be inspired, sometimes even appalled. And tonight we're very fortunate to have Stephen Asprenio. You probably know him from Top Chef. I get a chance to know him from before when he was being educated at the beautiful Cornell University. And tonight we're going to hear really a lot about Stephen, what makes him tick, and especially what he's doing now. So, Stephen, how you doing tonight?
Good, man. Thanks for having me, Chef. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure. It's been a long time since our old days together.
I know. It was a lot of fun. I was telling a story with Christopher Bates. Do you remember Christopher Bates?
Yeah, I hear he's doing well. He's got his own place, I think, now, and he's out west, right?
He's actually, Christopher Bates is now at the Relais and Chateau Hotel Faucher in Milford, Pennsylvania, and he's doing some great food, but he's also, like you, a sommelier, and he just came in third in that big sommelier slam, so he really likes that, you know?
Good thing, man. Enjoying wine while you're enjoying cooking. I mean, it's a great balance, and yeah, I think Chris was a great example of that. It's definitely somebody people should keep their eyes on in years to come. He was definitely a great talent, even back then.
Well, listen, real quick, people got a chance to watch you on Top Chef, but they don't know the whole layers, behind your life. Tell me real quick, you love food and beverage. That's your 100% passion. True or false?
True.
You're not just a one-dimensional guy. You're just not a chef, right? You're every dimension of the restaurant business. Tell us a little bit about right now what you're doing and where your passion lies.
Sure, man. So the big focus right now is really the whole, entrepreneurship that's behind hospitality and giving back. I mean, though still, fairly young at 29, I've had a great, level of experience. And there's been a lot of years that people much more experienced than myself have spent a lot of time and a lot of energy into me. And now I'm kind of hitting that point in my career where I can make the decision to, one, continue with, the ego madness and, build, restaurants that are more focused around that and more clout than actually being able to kind of penetrate the American public and increase, I guess, the overall level of quality in the American food scene. Something like, say, Steve Ells or Drew Brent or Danny Meyer and those types of guys. And, going way back when I was younger, I mean, my idol, and still I respect the man, just in an amazing manner. But, Thomas Keller, Jean George is another example.
Sure.
Daniel Ballou, that's who I wanted to be. And then it kind of shifted to, all right, now I want to be like a hotshot sommelier. And then shifted from there to wanting to be a restaurateur, and now it's kind of even taken a whole nother step, and it's more of like, what can I do to add value to the overall industry, and not just in restaurants, but in everything, whether it's just how people approach food and wine, making food and wine, or food and beverage in general, very accessible to people on an everyday level. And I think that's where, the real fun is, because, it's real cool to, make guest streaks and verblancs and braise, fish and, do crazy molecular gastronomy and all these other things. I mean, that's fun stuff to, pass the time, and it's good for yourself as an individual, but does that really, enhance the people around you? Yeah, it can make a few people happy, and hey, if you can make one person smile, that's fantastic, man. But now the overall approach is really kind of, again, going after the American public as a whole. So my next project that I'm launching, it's a prototype, going to be, I live down on Wall Street, Manhattan, and the restaurant's going to be in the financial district right near my home.
Sure.
And it's a prototype for this brand called Pizza Vinoteca. So it's going to be, not like there's enough pizza restaurants already, but what we're doing is a very unique style of pizza, too. It's in the Roman style, very thin. Everything's done on a grill. I think you can relate how amazing what grills can do, of course, and more so than most people. And no ovens, just take this, high high fat and rich, you know, lots of extra virgin olive oil dough, throw that on the grill, nice and crispy, that kind of thing. So it's not going to be your, you know, Neapolitan style. That's, you know, it's all the rave in New York City right now, with places like Motorino and Co., which are damn good, man. But this is going to be a little bit different. What we're doing is really following the model of, I don't want to say we're going to be the Chipotle of pizza, because you know, Steve Ells, the genius that he is still not something that I want to do. We're still trying to focus and encapsulate those elements of fine dining and kind of bringing them down a notch. So it's going to be that limited service aspect, but the quality level is still going to be just, you know, really kick ass, and it's going to be something really special. And I think that's what we're going to be able to say, hey, as opposed to serving 200 people a night, we'll be able to expand this prototype from Manhattan into a nationwide brand will really sing. And the coolest part about it, Chef, is that we're going to, you know, have the everyday wine component in there too. I mean, all the wine's going to be self-serve. You're going to order food from iPads. The wine is all going to be priced extremely at an extremely accessible price point. $6 a glass. I mean, that's typically unheard of. You know, you go to I don't know, man, like just a completely lame restaurant, and, you know, they're charging $8 for Merlot out of a jug. So what we're doing is we're going to be sourcing some really fantastic wines from around the world that are, you know, they haven't really hit that. The supply and demand chain. So, you know, people don't know about them. So, yeah, no, you're not going to see the big name brands on this wine list that we're going to be serving. But that's totally cool, because there's, you know, thousands of wines from around the world, whether it's from South Africa to Austria, Chile, Argentina, wherever, you know, Southern California. And we're going to take those wines and kind of feature them in our wine program alongside this this very interesting product. And that's going to be the experience, and kind of rolling it out so people can come and get a glass of wine and a pizza. And it's going to be, you know, $15.
I got to tell you, I like that. You know, my son lives in Mestrino, Italy, home of La Calandre. And but there's an Enoteca there. That when we go visit him, we go to, and I think, why doesn't someone in the U.S. get on this bandwagon? And it sounds like you're doing it. The other thing I like, though, is there are cantinas they have in Italy, you know, with the where you go in and just fill your bottle.
Oh, those are the best.
That's fantastic.
They do that. They're starting to do that some places here, too, where you can just, you know, just go out, you know, you have your bottle, and just like old school, you know, way back in the,
you know,
the Wild Wild West, where they throw the bottle on the bar, and that's kind of what they do at the Italian cantinas. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear about that, you know, at least in New York sometime soon.
Yeah, I think it's I thought it was a great idea. But listen, where did this passion you have? Because, you know, you're definitely, I think, you know, when I first met you, you know, I could see the passion, you know, coming out of you. And I love young passion. And that's why I enjoyed being at Cornell. I love people that are just, you know, they're young and they have all these ideas and they're going crazy. And you know, your mind was always flying around with everything. Where did this come from? I mean, is it your parents? Was it grandparents? Did it just happen one day? Like God came to you and was like, Steven.
Well, admittingly, partly I'm, you know, kind of completely out of my mind. So that probably has a lot to do with it. You know, with the whole, you know, almost borderline insane level of drive that's there from, you know, from a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. I don't sleep much at all. I'm constantly thinking. It's that classic entrepreneur complex of always, you know, thinking of ideas. And so, you know, I was kind of born with that, or built for that, with just an extreme level of passion of anything I've ever done, whether it was with music, art, food and wine, and everything since I've been, you know, a toddler. So, but no, it definitely does, you know, talking about food and beverage and, you know, where that originally stemmed from, definitely was from my family. I mean, I have everything to thank from their end, because, you know, if it wasn't for my mother and father, how they brought me up, how they trained my palate, and also how they pushed me to get into this industry, because my father is a medical physicist. My mother does cancer research oncology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't think that their son is going to end up, you know, I don't know, grilling steaks on a, you know, on a grill somewhere, some restaurant, you know, making $10 an hour when I should be in med school, you know. So it was a different thing, but it was their hobby and, you know, the culture of food and wine. And that's really where I think, you know, if you talk to anyone in our industry, that's where we really get excited, because it is an expression of different culture. My family being from Italy, that's where it really kind of came together, because my mother and father is individuals, total foodies, you know, we were sort of baby food. They were pureeing what they were eating, you know,
right.
Indian cuisine to Middle Eastern cuisine or whatever it was, you know, pureeing in a blender, turning that into baby food. And that's what we were eating. So we were eating, you know, probably better flavor profile than most people,
yeah.
you know, in their 40s or 50s at that time back in the early 80s. So it was really interesting. And so we were always had open minds, open palates, and just kind of like spawned from there. And my first cooking class I took when I was 5 years old. My mother was very enthusiastic about kind of just, you know, having all of myself and my three younger siblings kind of doing different activities,
That's
whether it's
awesome.
Different sports and, the arts and everything else and music. And then cooking, you know, that was what
yeah.
they loved to do. So they tried to kind of, you know, instill that into their children, and it really kind of took when it came in my case. So
mm-hmm.
It was fantastic, man. So long story short, in that, you know, in the adolescence phase, when I was in high school, after cooking, you know,
sure.
behind the stove, standing on a stool, making, you know, stuff out of cookbooks, you know, from Joyce Chen, simple Chinese dishes to,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of stuff from Julia Child and a lot of that classic cooking. And then
sure.
when I was in high school, I got my first restaurant job and prepping vegetables and washing dishes in a Chinese restaurant. I mean, you know, the line cooks are flicking cigarette butts, you know, at me. I mean, talk about, you know, that Kitchen Confidential-esque mentality
yeah, yeah, right.
that Bourdain always talked about. And that's not, I mean, I would never, ever live my life that way. I would
sure.
never, you know, employ a restaurant of that nature. But back then, you know, it was still that mentality. And it was funny. I mean, the young guy, the new guy, whoever you were, whether you were a punk kid in high school or you were 40, if you're the new person
yeah.
in the kitchen, you know how it is, man.
Yeah,
you
sure.
get,
did you get, now, were you were in Florida? You grew up in Florida?
Yeah, this is all happening. This is Palm Beach County, South
right.
Florida. I grew up in a little town called Wellington,
mm-hmm.
out in the western Palm Beach County. And,
sure.
And, yeah, so that's where this was going on. So this was not like a big food town, too. That
right.
was another thing. I mean, my parents, they were probably better cooks. I don't say probably, I'd say definitely. They were better cooks as individuals and more so as a team, you know, on a nightly basis when we were having dinner than any restaurant in town. I mean, we would go out and it would be a joke. We'd be like,
right,
it's hilarious.
Sure.
We can do this better at home. So, that was kind of creating this almost, and by default, like this, I don't want to say an elitist mentality, but.
Sure.
It kind of was at that point, and that's not something I'm proud of, but it was kind of always like, you know, I can do this better, I am better, and when it came
yeah, but
to
look,
wine.
Look at what your parents do for a living. I mean, they had to work really hard to get where they were, you know, that you just don't do what they do just by a joke. I mean, they really worked hard, so they probably took that same thing in their life outside. I've seen a lot of these people. I grew up in a medical family. And outside of work, when they'd work so hard, they're still everything else. They put that same passion into, and it must have really rubbed off, and you know, put that thing in you that you're working just as hard at your particular field as they did to become what they are, and that's huge, really.
That was awesome. I mean, it was the best educational experience from like coming right from the household. You know, growing up, but I, of course, you know, back then, you know, again, just a punk kid taking everything
mm-hmm.
for granted until years later where I, you know, really had this kind of newfound appreciation for what they did for me back then because, you know, it was always so tough
sure.
growing up in a household like that. They were great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just fantastic. They didn't push us to the point where, I mean, it was always like, you know, love your children first and then kind of instill values, you know, not pushing them over the edge where, like, you forget that, you know, these are actually your parents and they're raising
yeah.
you in an unbelievable manner. So that was nice because, you know, of course, you know, in communities like that, you had the parents who, you know, the father driving their kid to almost, you know, borderline insanity
sure.
because he has to be the best on the baseball team. It wasn't like that. It was just basically best that you can be, but while
mm-hmm.
still being happy. And they've
sure.
always had that, you know, that approach with all four children and no matter what, you know, so if it wasn't big success, that's fine. You know, again, as long as you're happy, no matter what you do. But I kind of took it to a whole nother level, and I ended up developing this set of, like, just unrelenting standards, like standards that I could barely hold myself, and I would hold those everyone else around me to those standards, and
sure.
when I was younger, I kind of alienated myself, which, again, looking back, it was, you know, when I know what, at the top, it's a lonely place, man,
yeah.
you know, and that's the one thing I've learned, because there was a period where I kind of felt bad about that. I was like, man, you know, maybe I should have been a little more warm and, you know, humble about it, and it's like, well, if you do... there's going to be a million other people who are just going to run you over. So,
you know, look, knowing you from the time you were at Cornell, if you'd have been all warm, I would have beat you down anyway. So, you know,
you would have.
I'd have been like, what is wrong with you, man? No, honestly, think about it. You went to then to the Culinary Institute of America.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about, you know, a family like yours that had to work really hard, education wise to get where they were. Now, you know, when you go to the culinary, at least when I was there, there were not a lot of people who were there that had that mentality, that really looked at that school as if I'm going to learn everything I can. I'm going to spend every moment, you know, pulling everything from every teacher. I'm going to get so much out of this. Did you find that when you were there that like only a small percentage of people were like that? The other ones were just like, hey, I'm at school. I'm going to cook and then I'm going to go party afterwards and that type of thing.
Yeah, that was definitely, I mean, I think there were more people because, you know, you got to remember when I was just hitting culinary school, I think it was 1999. Food Network had been out for several years at that point.
Sure.
Like the whole celebrity chefdom was like really, you know, taking America by storm. You know, the likes of Jean-Georges, Rocco Dispirito back then was an icon, not because of some TV personality of doing the restaurant on Fox, but because of Union Pacific. You know, I mean, these were like, so these guys are really kind of setting the standard. So a lot of people at the school, at the culinary, you know, the Culinary Institute of America being, without a doubt, the Harvard of culinary schools and, you know, the best culinary training in the world that you can get, the students did, you know, by large, appreciate it, but there was definitely, I'd say, close to 50-50 where there was these guys like, cooking is a joke. I'm just here because this is what my parents paid for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to goof off, do drugs, you know, and not really, you know, have a balance. I mean, it was fun. We partied our asses off at that school, but we would be out till 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning. We would get up and go to class at 7 or 8. These guys, they'd show up and they would just be lazy. They wouldn't study, and it was really horrible because you're talking, you know, it'd be like at Cornell, somebody being at an institution like that, and just kind of rolling their eyes and just, you know, when people would kill for an education like that. And I think, but that was fine because I saw that was fine because I saw that as an opportunity to succeed. I was like, all right, these are my peers, no problem. This is going to be easy. And it was for a long time. I mean, I was the youngest in my class at CIA, one of them. There was one young lady who was a couple months younger than myself.
Sure.
But everyone was older. Everyone was, like, on second careers. And, you know, God bless them, you know, half of them actually did stay, you know, fast-forwarding to present day. They're still in the industry. But, you know, the rest of them, they're all dropped out.
Yeah.
You know how hard it is in this business. So these guys couldn't even hang. And that was the funniest thing about it was, you know, I knew better because I worked in the industry for 4 years before I went, you know, from all the way freshman year of high school until I graduated. So I knew what the business was about. I knew you don't go to culinary school and then all of a sudden you're a chef when you get out and you're making $50,000. No, you get out of your $50,000 education and you're making maybe $10 an hour and probably doing shit work somewhere. You know, I mean, you guys, you really wanted to, you know, be players and went to go work for Danielle for free in New York City, and they didn't even have a paycheck coming out of school. So, you know, it was a different thing. So then you had these clowns who were like, yeah, I'm going to be a chef. And lo and behold, 2 years later, what are they doing? They're, you know, prepping vegetables at a country club somewhere, completely waste of an education. So it was interesting to see that. But again, survival of the fittest. I was totally cool with that.
Who at school inspired you? Were there any teachers that you really latched on to?
Well, I was very friendly because, especially the Culinary Institute of America, I'd become very friendly with the deans and, you know, President Ryan from the Culinary Institute. I ran into the other day, and he was just coming into office when President Metz was kind of stepping down into his emeritus position. So it was great because I was always, you know, so driven, as we were talking about before, about the whole passion thing. So I did so many extracurricular activities, so I was able to not just have the day-to-day life at the culinary school, but I was also involved with a lot of the instructors and, again, the deans of the school. So they kind of took me under their wing. I would say the wine professors, though, at the Culinary Institute were the ones who really kind of helped me reshape the focus of what I've been doing over the past, you know, I think at that point, like 4 or 5 years, and say, hey, listen, there's a whole other world. I mean, that's kind of today what my specialty is. It's not just wine, not just food. it's a combination of both. It's on the operational level, obviously, there's many other aspects of the restaurant that I focus on, but that was like this defining moment where they said, you know, because up to that point, I was like, oh, yeah, you drink to get drunk, have fun, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that is kind of an extent to what wine is. It shouldn't be taken too seriously. But what they showed me was like the beauty of like what wines are and the hard work that these farmers, wine growers, winemakers really put into each and every bottle, and how amazing that they can, you know, that they can make it a dining experience, and the value that's increased when you introduce a bottle of wine to an amazing dish or creation from a chef. So that probably, you know, the time where I'd say my instructors really kind of catapulted, you know, me into a point of my career where it was probably one of the most fantastic times. I mean, I wasn't even old enough to drink. I was going down to tastings in New York with my professors. We were, you know, surrounded by some of the best sommeliers in the United States, and there I am, you know, 18 years old, you know, drinking wine, swirling Bordeaux, you know, differentiating between, you know, the left and right banks and the varietals and the characteristics and each of the different winemakers of the different regions. I mean, it was just an eye-opening experience. And then, as you know, kind of from there, it took me to great places. But same thing at Cornell, too.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, you always gravitate towards what you can relate to. It was food and beverage. You know, Stephen Mikoski, he was, you know, just an amazing, you know, inspiration for me, his approach to wine. And, you know, just everyone else in the food and beverage department over at the hotel school at Cornell, they really, you know, helped me because I didn't even take their classes. I'd already done all those classes back at CIA. So it was cool, man, to, you know, have them kind of still be there and being playing teaching assistant for these different classes. But I was still learning from them, even though I was more interested in being enrolled in stuff that I wasn't familiar with, such as like real estate finance or, you know, different levels of accounting and those kind of things, which is where I thought Cornell really came into play for me and shaped me into the business individual that I am today.
Well, don't you think, you know, after being at Cornell, I noticed the difference between chef school and Cornell. You know, first of all, chef school, the people that are there usually don't form these great alliances. But at Cornell, I noticed how students of different types would form these alliances. So one student was really strong in food and beverage, and another student was really strong in accounting, and another one was really strong in real estate acquisition. And they would end up, you know, not even on purpose, just kind of gravitating towards each other and then going out and being able to start businesses and things. And I thought that was unbelievable. I just, you know, you know how they say, you know, chefs have a lot of egos and they all think they're going to be better than each other. But at Cornell, I didn't see that. More people were really focused on how can I be good at business, which I thought was pretty awesome.
It was nice to see the ego out of the equation. That was for sure. I mean, yeah, definitely. What was Cornell's slogan, you know, elite, not elitist. And we definitely saw that a lot with these students because they knew that they were going to be successful. They had nothing to prove. The insecurities that are just, you know, laden throughout the culinary end of the industry with many of these chefs who just aren't comfortable in their own skin, don't really know what they're capable of doing and are always trying to prove something, whether it's to themselves or their peers. That always gets in the way of success. At Cornell, these students, young men, young women were so confident. It wasn't cockiness. It was a really just a refreshing level of success already had at the educational level.
Sure.
Let alone when you see and now you look back and you see where, you know, from my class at 2004, you know, what the students are doing. It's amazing. They're running companies.
Yeah, you have some great you know, folks, I mean, right? It's unbelievable, really.
It is.
You know what else is funny to me when I thought about this, and you know, all the students were so bright that one student, you know, like yourself, for instance, who would come in and say, I've eaten at all these restaurants and I tasted all these things. All of a sudden, you had all these other people that were at the same level, and then all of a sudden, you're like, whoa, I'm not that great. I remember, you know, I used to use a lot of BS in my kitchen just to get people to keep moving. And I realized I could not lie to any of these students because they would research everything I said and they would come back and they'd be like, you know, and I'd be like, well, I was just bullshitting, you know, and they'd be like, well, I was listening to you. And that was also a big lesson for me because you know, it actually changed the way that I actually operated as a manager, and it was good for me. So I enjoyed my time too. I think I had a little education while I was there. So Stephen, now we after Cornell, you ended up going where, and how did you end up actually on that particular show? I mean, how did you end up going from Cornell out in the work world, and then all of a sudden there you are on Top Chef season one?
Yeah, season one. I was 24 years old, which was interesting. It was a little premature, I think, for making my national television debut. You know, still and again finding myself and growing. Obviously, I'm still doing that today, but back then it was an eye opener. And I'll go backwards in a second, but you know, yeah. At that time, I remember just watching myself on national television, and you learn a lot about yourself if you ever go on national television and you see yourself and how you act and everything. And I have no regrets, and it was cool. And that was definitely Stephen Asprenio at 24. I mean, that was a great depiction of who I was. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of editing, and you know, they only show, you know, it's very a one-dimensional part of your personality that they portray. But, you know, when you come out of it as such a better person, because, you know, you're able to take away, and it's like almost like, you know, you're videotaping your life, and you just watch that and learn from that. So, yeah, it was pretty funny. But backtracking 2 seconds before, you know, that happened, you know, Cornell to Vegas, it was on that wine track. And that's kind of what, like, why Top Chef was, why the producers of Top Chef, NBC, Bravo, were so attracted to kind of what I was able to bring to the table, because I was this different entity. You know, they were looking for, obviously, you know, the first cast of Top Chef. They didn't even know what the show was going to be. They knew that they were going to model the show off of Project Runway. It was the same producers. Project Runway was a wild, wild success at the time.
Right.
And they said, well, we're going to do something for chefs. So they were looking for chef personalities. But I even, you know, speaking to the casting producers after that, they never thought, oh, we would get this kid at 24, who was like, you know, the youngest sommelier in the United States, who has this, you know, amazing culinary background, worked for Nobu and all these other people, who could hang in the kitchen with their other contestants, let alone, you know, I made it, you know, just up to right before the finale.
Right.
And if I just kind of stayed focused and didn't go so crazy with my ego and, you know, and kind of stepped outside my, what I was comfortable of doing with food and wine and just focused on the competition, you know, I probably could have made it further, But that aside, yeah, man, I mean, you know, they're in Vegas working for Michael Mina as wine director of one of his restaurants. Michael, you know, I mean, he's named, you know, top chef, or the, you know, number one chef in America by Bon Appetit several years back. I mean, the guy was and still is an icon.
Right.
Him and his wine director, Raj Parr, just, you know, provided this amazing experience. And I used that combined with Top Chef and basically flipped that, catapulted myself and put my career on, like, literally fast forward to my first restaurant. You know, I landed secured a multi-million dollar investment for my first restaurant at 25, opened it at, you know, 26, ran it for a little while, sold it, and, you know, moved on from there. So it was a crazy time back then, you know, in, you know, first season of a show, you have no idea what's going to happen. And all of a sudden you're this, you know, I don't know, whatever, X-list celebrity of some sort. And, you know, you're, I don't know, because I'm a very private person, always have been. And you don't have an option.
I was at
the Chicago airport the other night, you know, flying back from the NRA show, and a bunch of girls start screaming. Security runs over. I almost got arrested. These girls just wanted to take a picture. It was hilarious. It was, you know, so that kind of stuff happened.
You know, that didn't happen when you were Cornell. I don't remember girls screaming when you were. When you were walking through the hallway,
screaming.
Hey, look, I got to say, though, really, look, they did a great job casting you. And if they would have asked me, I would have said the same thing. Because, look, you know, when you were younger, you're talking about your personality. I used to say, you know, Stephen is full of piss and vinegar. Because, you know, you really, you know, you were passionate about everything. This was a nice thing about you, because you grew on people back then. At first, that, you know, people just want to say, shut the hell up, Stephen, you know, because you had so much to say about everything. But, you know, after people got to know you, they realized that the things you were saying really weren't BS. You know, they were for real, and they meant something. So, you know, you just when you're, you know, when you're young and you really are passionate, you know, sometimes things come out. And I think that's probably why they cast you. I think you had known Tom Colicchio before.
Yeah, we've met before.
So, well, whatever. I think they, you know, they were like, well, this guy, he's definitely going to stir things up a little bit, which is, and he's not going to, you know, you don't back down. So you're not going to be one of those people like step back, you know, because a lot of sommeliers probably would be like, I'll step back and let someone else do it. But, you know, you were in people's faces and you did things, and that made for great freaking television. I loved it. I was rooting for you. You know, and,
it was a good time, man. Yeah, it was pretty fun.
And so you look back and maybe
it was funny to watch. We had viewing parties every week, man. It was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe when you look back, you're like, whoa, but, you know, it's okay, you know, because it's a learning thing. But if you wouldn't have had that drive and you wouldn't have been full of what I say, piss and vinegar, you wouldn't be where you are now. So, you know, I was proud to watch you on there and the other seasons too. So tell me about, real quick, you know, on that show, was there any people that you met that, you know, made an impact on you? I mean, just name some people and maybe what they brought to your life.
I think from season one, it was really cool to, you know, befriend Harold Dieterle, who ended up, you know, winning the season. Mm-hmm. He was a cool guy. He was very, like, level-headed, and it was funny because, you know, there was such a big age, you know, gap at the time. And
right.
Jumping back to what you were saying before of, you know, definitely being proud of everything and the experience, and I totally was. If I was 34, you know, a little older, I think it'd be a different story. And Harold was, I think, just approaching 30 or something at that mm-hmm. time, and obviously, you know, this is, you know, 6 years later now. So Harold's kind of matured into this very kind of level-minded chef, and like yourself, and mm-hmm. you guys are very unique in that way that,
thank you
know, you can maintain your calm in the kitchen. Still to this day, so many chefs, they just, you know, lose their minds, you know, in mm-hmm. the kitchen. They should take what they do seriously, as mm-hmm. we all should, but they shouldn't take themselves so seriously. And
true
Harold
enough.
Was one of those types that it didn't. He knew how to relax while still putting out a AAA product, and that was really great to see. And then, you know, fast forwarding to All Stars, which we shot this past, you know, fall.
Right.
Which is finished airing.
It was a great series, by the way. I loved it.
Oh, man, yeah. What a group of talent that was. I mean, it was, they interviewed me. I think they took a little out of context because I didn't mean to say that season one was a joke compared to, you know, All Stars. It was just, it was such a staggering difference because, you know, mm-hmm. season one was a very diverse mix. And
sure.
who made
and it was a prototype, too, you know.
You know, but All Stars, man, was just straight talent. I mean, everybody there.
Yeah, right.
Kick ass. If you eat their food in the real world, they're going to blow you out of the water. I mean, mm-hmm. people bag on Marcel, but that kid can cook. You know, I mean, his food is tasty. You know, Richard Blaze in a similar style, but still a different manner.
Sure.
Fabio is, you know, he's not just Mr. Charming. Like, he is a mm-hmm. damn good Italian cook. You know?
Yeah.
So those are the types of things that it was really great to see because, you know, I don't really follow the show. I mean, I'd watch an episode here and there. I don't even own a television. I work 120 hours a week and I'm time to, you know, watch television like most people do. So
sure.
I just remember my experience, you know, oh yeah, season one and then coming back for the four-star all-star thing with, you know, when we,
right.
season one was pitted against season two, which was, that was pretty cool actually.
I like that. I like that. You know, I was rooting for you against Marcel, you know, that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, I whooped his ass.
Yeah, you did. And I was talking some crap in my kitchen the next day, you know, let me tell you something. My favorite moment to talk crap about of all of the Top Chef was when that Joey from Cafe des Artistes started bawling when they kicked him out.
Oh God,
man, that was great. The next day I just went in and I said, did you guys see that? If any of you cry in my kitchen, I am going to personally pick you up and throw you out on the
floor. Yeah, that was embarrassing. I felt bad. I mean, you know, nice kid and all, sweet
sure.
guy, but damn, I was like, you seriously just, you know, and then you look at the opposite of someone like Marcel, like who would mm-hmm. never, I mean, that he was like, I think Marcel was like the best, even though he's like he's evolved into a, you know, great chef now
yeah.
and, you know, and where his career is. But he, back then, you know, when he was on the show, he was a line cook, but
right.
he was a real line cook. I mean, that guy, I mean, he didn't care what anyone said. I mean, remember people started, I think, yeah, someone, they literally went after him at one point, you know, which was crazy.
Yeah, but right.
That was kind of that unrelenting thing, whereas Joey kind of just, you know, broke down and started crying. So Definitely a unique mix of these personalities over the seasons that I've, again, kind of sporadically seen. Angelo Sosa, another one that, you know, people should definitely keep an eye out for. Mm-hmm. I got to kind of watch him as he cooked and everything. And that guy, surprisingly enough, you know, obviously he didn't even make it to the finale. It was whatever happened. But
yeah, sure.
You know, that guy's a hell of a talent, man. I mean, that guy's, you know, he's trained by Jean-Georges, and you can tell, you know, Jean-Georges. Yeah. For me, probably being one of my favorite chefs in the United States.
Right.
You know, you see that style in Angelo, and that was another guy, I think, you know, that kind of added some value to my, like, you know, my education. And he's the one who even said, too, the best part of All Stars, I think he said in an interview with one of the magazines, he said the best part of that show was all of us being in that house, all of us cooking together. It was like going back to school because, you know, Richard's busting out stuff that no one's seen.
Yeah.
You know, Fabio's bringing some unique, you know, cooking technique from Italy. You know, Elia's, you know, bringing something from her background and culture. Like, I mean, everybody had something to bring to the table, whereas, like, seasons past, it's kind of, you know, half of them are knuckleheads, and,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
And the other half are really, like, you know, really sharp, but they're usually kind of, you know, they're at, like, the same level. You had such a diverse mix of backgrounds and culinary technique and everything for All Stars. That's why I think, I don't know what they're going to do for this next season. I know they've already casted and they're, you know, rolling with that hopefully soon.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, let me ask, because that was really good. With when you shoot Top Chef and before the finale, so you got however many days, I can't remember, was it 17 challenges or whatever? Do you do that like day after day, or do you get a break?
No breaks, day after day. I remember season one because, you know, first season show, there's no budgets. You know, I mean, they literally, like, every day that they go, you know, they have the production team, you know, on retainer.
Yeah, right.
Then, you know, you're just, I mean, you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars. So, no, they just push you. And it's good because they're pushing you to such a limit that, you know, a lot of people break down, cry, whatever. So it kind of serves two purposes. One, getting it done in a budget budget timely manner, but also it really just brings everyone's stress level, like, to a peak. And God only knows what happens. I mean, over, you know, you've seen, I mean, there's been, you know, knives flying, people fighting, you know, some crazy stuff, and that's kind of how they do it. But yeah, usually it's straight through. We usually do 2 days an episode. So yeah, I mean, for us it was like 30 for the first season. All Stars was a little longer, so.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, in All Stars, there was one thing that I wish you would have made it to: swimming for the conchs. I would have loved to have seen you in shorts swimming out there. Poor Richard, he couldn't swim to save his life. But when I saw them do that, when I saw them do that,
that would have been funny.
I know. I you would have had a pair of nice shoes on. You just walked out, grabbed those damn conchs, you know. But anyway, look. Stephen, before we finish, is there, you know, people that are listening, is there anything you'd want them to know about you that we haven't talked about?
I mean, I think we pretty much covered, you know, the kind of whole background story and everything. I think the one, you know, takeaway with, like, food and wine and hospitality, entrepreneurship and everything, and for, especially for the younger, you know, generation who's up mm-hmm. and coming and really sure. looking to, you know, stand their ground and make a big splash in the industry, is not, like I think we mentioned before, to kind of get wrapped up with, like, the whole, you know, ego-driven madness and really just kind of focus on what we do best, and that's what's making people happy. And it's hilarious because, you know, and you remember me way back when, it was,
sure.
you know, this very, you know, driven in a sense that, you know, I would just tear down anyone in my path. But now, you know, it's kind of, I've had this, like, revelation and an eye-opening experience where, well, one, I'm just getting older, and I think that's going to happen with
right.
most people. Some people never grow up, and that's a shame. But for, you know, for myself, it's been a really great experience, and it's been a hell of a ride. And this is all going to somewhat culminate, obviously, in my next project. You know, America is really going to get to see, you know, what I'm capable of doing, not at a fine dining level, but at a level where, like, you know, the everyday person can come experience something
sure.
great at Pizza Vinoteca, and also. Later this year, hopefully simultaneously or just before, I'll be coming out with finally, never get around to it because I'm always so damn busy, but my
sure.
first book, which is tentatively titled right now, Eat and Drink Until You Die. And it's going to be just a book that basically just rips down, you know, all food, wine. beverage, everything at its roots, throws it on the ground. You can kind of just see it for what it is and enjoy it for something amazing, but not something that's pretentious. So
yeah, sure.
That'll be cool, and that'll be out towards the end of the year, man. So I'll
look forward to that
copy as soon as it comes out. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on Chew the Fat. I think the folks that are going to listen are going to really enjoy it, and we've had some really good response, and I know they're gonna like listening to you. It's amazing that show became such a huge hit, and you know, I'm thankful that I was able to have someone I could root for like you. So, you know, don't do any of those shows like where you go in and fight, though. You know, like Tonya Harding when she got older and stuff, went boxing with Danny Bonaduce.
The surreal life, yeah.
No, yeah,
I,
yeah.
I
don't ever want to see you on that. You call me
before I do that.
Yeah, if you get tempted, call me. No, I'm just kidding. I know you're going to do great things. I look forward to your restaurant, and I look forward to talking to you soon. So thanks so much for being on. And folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat. This is Chef Craig Hartman. Have a wonderful night.
Was never the name of a restaurant. That was always just the name of this song. And I guessed it. Well, that's probably why I still call this song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back. Just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. I wasn't gonna sing the song tonight, or this decade, but I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that it came out as a record. And it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago. 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, and there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we come to a side road, and off of the side of the side road there was a 15-foot cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile would be better than two little ones, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it. And I said, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie.